Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to the fourth of my sessions in terms of journalism studies and so on. Don't worry too much about whether the screen has gone blank on us, because after all, the first part of the talk is going to be about radio, which makes a kind of bizarre sense. And obviously, as I'll take you through the next 40 or so minutes on mass broadcasting, mass BBC work, etc., we'll look at some of the aspects related to radio, and indeed we'll go on to consider the way in which the newspapers responded to the BBC, etc. We'll talk you through some of the key elements with respect to that, including as we actually approach the centenary of the BBC in 2022, whether there is a future for the British Broadcasting Corporation, which again is a whole hot debate to actually be considered and worked through as well. So let's consider some of the facts in terms of the history of the BBC, in terms of how it developed. And there are two dates that you can see online there which are particularly critical: 1922 and 1927. Parliament had basically wanted to avoid what was happening in America when it came to this newfangled medium called radio, this thing which had been around pretty much since the turn of the 20th century in various forms. The first kind of broadcasts were set up by a group of radio hams in America, radio amateurs, hence radio hams, etc. And they broadcast from banks in San Jose onwards and would actually have some very crude sort of point-to-point communications on what we would now recognise as the medium wave or AM frequencies and so on. But apart from a short period of time from the time in which America entered the First World War in 1917, when the American Navy nationalised and took over all of the airwaves, pretty much what was the case in America was that if you had the money to actually purchase a licence to broadcast, you could do that. And that was viewed with suspicion from this side of the Atlantic. It was viewed as basically creating chaos of the airwaves and issues relating to that. And that chaos of the airwaves was seen as something we didn't want to go down that particular road. We wanted to go down a road in Britain which was, shall we say, more civilised, more effective, maybe actually arguably more state-controlled. And so it was deemed that one company could actually be formed from the post office at the time to actually look after the collection and the setting of fees that would be collected from people purchasing radio receiver sets. Radio receiver sets which weren't too different from that, a little bit more sophisticated perhaps, but ultimately a way of actually receiving broadcast radio standards and so on. The wireless, as it came to be called. And so the British Broadcasting Company was established in 1922. And it took 5 years to basically prove itself until it was actually awarded the notion of becoming the British Broadcasting Corporation that we know and appreciate it being today. So let's look at the audience for this thing called radio. Well, between 1922 to 1939, the number of radio licences for every 100 households in Britain actually went from a total of 36,000 in 1922 to 8.9 million in 1939. So a huge growth there in terms of, and it's really good data, because obviously one of the things about everybody who purchased a radio licence, a licence to the BBC, which remained the case even when television was brought in, and then the television licence incorporates radio as well in recent years, it shows the kind of level of growth, 36,000 to 8.9 million. The ownership of radio receivers was actually most popular in London, the South East and the Midlands. Perhaps not surprising, areas like the north of Scotland, where it was actually difficult to get a good quality signal, etc. There was less popularity from that point of view. The ownership of those radio licences, and therefore radio sets, percolated down the social system until pretty much in the 1940s, start of Second World War, roughly about a third of working class households didn't have a radio. So two-thirds of working class households did, a third didn't. In his book on broadcasting history, Ross McKibben actually noted that families actually differed in the way that they listened to radio. There was a tendency in working-class households to turn the radio set on and leave it on. Middle-class households were more discriminating. The set was turned on for particular programmes, and it was turned off when they ended. And that more discerning approach to listening was actually assisted by the BBC and encouraged by the BBC, who inserted moments of silence between programmes because, effectively, they wanted to ensure that the right people were listening to the right programmes, and you listened to the programme, and then you left the programme. So it wasn't that kind of continuous background noise that we tend to appreciate radio as being today. Now, the period in terms of the BBC's audience growing coincided, obviously, with the philosophy of the BBC itself. Technology was obviously improving, the wireless radio set was becoming very important, and I don't want to sort of say that television wasn't happening about this time, because it was. The first television set was presented to Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister, in 1930 as a television receiver. There were certainly working radio signals and transmissions in the mid-1930s, up until the outbreak in Britain of hostilities against Germany in World War II on September 1939. And it wasn't until after the war that, again, radio developed. The reason radio was suspended in Britain was because there was concern, initially, that the transmitter, being based in Alexander Palace, would have acted as a homing device for German bombers to effectively target and so on. So they felt, actually, we need to step away from that. Unofficially, or maybe perhaps close to the truth, most of the people who actually worked for the BBC in television went off to develop a little thing called radar, which was very critical in terms of the war effort. So again, you saw a shift, see a shift in terms of where things were actually going. In 1933, Radio Luxembourg also started its transmissions, and Radio Luxembourg for a long time was the only way in Britain that we could actually hear commercial broadcasting. Radio that was actually inclusive of adverts, radio in which shows were sponsored, and so on. This again had developed in the States very much in terms of soap operas. Soap operas were actually called soap operas because Procter and Gamble were the main soap company that sponsored these kind of on-air radio dramas and so on. So this whole notion of commercial stations was very much seen as something which was a byproduct of radio. It wasn't seen that was something that was going to be encouraged by the BBC, which was, of course, as we said, funded by the licence fee. So how did it actually go on to develop its particular issue? Well, the BBC devised a number of popular variety programmes. Those variety programmes would combine comedy, they'd combine a whole range of other issues with respect to that, and again, they would also cover the notion of John Reith's particular philosophy of to inform, educate, and entertain. I've kind of expanded some of the key developments on the slide there in terms of how things were developed and worked through that. And as you can see, it wasn't a case of here's 5 years and then apply back and we'll make you into a corporation. The Sykes Commission effectively really made that final recommendation that the BBC should not be controlled by the state, it should be regulated by the state. Very critical when you bear in mind the three models that we actually have for broadcasting, pretty much until the present day, even with things like social media and various other things. You have initially radio and television as totally commercial operations, in which funding is paid for by people paying for advertising space and sponsorship. And then there's the totally state-controlled organisations of China, of the Soviet Union, etc., where the state will quite clearly control exactly what's being said, and the broadcasters are little more than mouthpieces for the particular governments in power. And then, of course, you have this BBC, which is supposedly something which gets that happy medium. It's one of the reasons why probably at no time has the BBC actually been immune to attack from either left-wing or right-wing. There are always kind of biases that come through with respect to that. And in 1925, as you can see there, the Crawford Committee actually recommended that broadcasting itself should effectively take place by this public corporation, critical word this, acting as a trustee for the nation. This is where we start beginning to see those openings from a journalist's point of view of how the BBC is representing the British public and so on. But there's still an issue. There's an issue that certainly the press barons at the time were very concerned about. If you recall what I was talking about in terms of newsreels all those days, weeks ago, newsreels were set up as being very popular within cinemas and so on, but they were also partially owned by press barons. You'd have press interests who basically would run the Express, the Mail and so on, who would also have a slice of the action of the newsreels. That was never going to occur within the BBC. It couldn't, because of the establishment of the actual licence fee model, you couldn't have that cross-media ownership. And so newspapers at the time were very concerned that people would buy their radio set, pay their licence fee, and get all their news from radio, and would stop buying the Times, the Telegraph, the Mail, and so on and so forth. So, again, certain strictures were put in place. The BBC could only provide headlines or news bulletins. They could only do one of those per day, and that could only be a maximum of 3 to 5 minutes at 7 p.m. on the evening of that day. So, as you can see, if you're looking for the news as current, it's already out of date by the time it's being broadcast. Come the general strike, you have something else that's really quite fascinating. The general strike is a period where effectively the whole nation, as its name suggests, actually goes on strike, with a few notable exceptions against the government. And the BBC hardly ever covered it. And the only time they did actually cover it was very much to take the government's side. Now, Reith's policy on that was that, well, the government were elected by the people. The people effectively had chosen the government, and so as a result of that, clearly the government would be right. So in taking the government side, the BBC was simply reflecting the views of the people. It's an interesting circumlocuous route. Again, strategically, it's thought that the reason Reith was concerned he didn't want to take an anti-governmental position was because he was looking to obviously secure the whole notion of the British Broadcasting Corporation. And indeed, they were allowed from 1927 to have a couple of other extra minutes per day, etc. So as you can see, you've got an interesting sort of combination of how the corporation relates to the state. Each of the elements that the BBC actually operate under in terms of the licence fee come down to the notion of the granting of the Royal Charter, which roughly takes place every 10 years. The next one is scheduled for 2027, obviously the centenary of the British Broadcasting Corporation. And already the current Director General of the BBC, Tony Hall, has decided he's had enough, he's out of there, there's a new vacancy for the Director General's job, etc. So again, issues to be had with respect to that. Paddy Scannell and David Cardiff actually wrote, "The state keeps the BBC on its toes, not through the threat of direct intervention, but via a number of indirect ways. First, the BBC had never had the right, and never has had the right, to broadcast in perpetuity." It's not a case of it's always going to be there. There's always the sort of notion that at any particular time, its funding, via the licence fee, would be taken away. "The licence fee itself has always been granted for a strictly limited time period, and it's always been subject to review." And you can hear that dialogue happening now in terms of, obviously, people who have a particular angle to portray. I even heard a rumour that we might indeed have, as a successor to Tony Hall and obviously John Reith back in the day, Elizabeth Murdoch has been put forward as a possible chair of the BBC or Director General, which would be quite intriguing. Possible conflict of interest, given her father's involvement with News International, but who knows? "The state also controls the purse strings, and it is the only place that the licence fee can actually be increased. And lastly, the governing body of the BBC, the Board of Governors, are pretty much chosen by the government," okay, in terms of who actually sits on the Board of Governors for the BBC. So that complex relationship with the state inevitably actually leads to news coverage being potentially troublesome. This remains the case pretty much until the Second World War, when the BBC begins to find its feet, when John Reith actually leaves, and there's the opportunity to obviously report in slightly more detail on events and so on. That original BBC licence, as I mentioned, issued in 1922, severely restricted the BBC's ability to broadcast news in any way, shape or form. As I said, newspaper owners were so alarmed at the prospect of radio news robbing them of newspaper sales that they lobbied Parliament, and as a result, as noted, the BBC's first licence stipulated that BBC news reports were to be strictly limited to news summaries, prepared or externally by a consortium of news agencies, including writers and the Press Association, and then they could only be broadcast after 7 p.m. so that there was no way in which they really could be seen to adversely affect the daily sales figures of newspapers. Now, the general strike, as I say, of 1926, as we pass over John Reith's image there, the first Director General. And actually, before we talk about general strike, let's talk a bit about John Reith. He was the BBC's first Managing Director. He was an individual who very much polarised people who actually met him and spoke to him, etc. Some people would say he was a traditional Scottish, Calvinistic-oriented, educated individual who was harsh, he was ruthless, he was determined. He saw basically broadcasting as a crusade, a personal crusade, to effectively address issues that he was particularly keen to address. He was a fairly large individual. He was overwhelming. Some people said he was abusive. He used to basically rubbish individuals quite regularly, refer to them as stupid. He was basically, in one sense, pompous, humourless, arrogant. His daughter actually said that he was anti-Semitic, he was self-pitying, he was autocratic, he was intimidating. These are not good positive phrases. These are not good adjectives to define an individual, especially basically when you have a situation where staff who work for John Reith either had to toe the line or basically leave the company, head off to various other areas. There were certainly far more men than women in significant jobs in the BBC. There were women in jobs in the BBC, but they tended to be secretarial. It was a long time before the BBC effectively got women in the roles of producers or programme makers and so on. As noted, in many senses, the BBC was supposed to be a business, but for John Reith, it was seen very much as a crusade, a way in which he would actually sort of address that whole system. And according to Reith himself, radio broadcasting was to be the sword that parted the clouds of ignorance. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Reith was this horrendous antichrist of a figure, even though when he left the BBC in 1937, the first record that was actually played on BBC Radio was Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? There was a big issue in terms of his approach to radio especially. And there's also an argument that on one level he wasn't really interested in television. He maintained that television was a fad, that it was not really going to take off, and he was so disappointed with the first demonstrations he'd seen, he really wasn't impressed with that at all. But at the same time, he did actually coin that phrase, which is very much at the front of Broadcasting House, that the role of the BBC is to inform, educate and entertain. He saw the BBC as an organisation which would lead public taste. He would probably be spinning in his grave if we informed him of the kind of focus groups and fact-finding areas that are developed these days in terms of how audiences are invited to feed into our BBC, your BBC, and so on. According to Reith himself, broadcasting should increase public and national harmony. It should bring all classes together, and it should reinforce a sense of national identity and unity. It was, of course, the British Broadcasting Company. And again, interesting to think about the sort of approaches with respect to that. Now, with his strong views, it's difficult not to agree with the writers Curran and Seaton, who wrote the following. The British Broadcasting Company was set up as a business. Reith turned it into a crusade. As the historian A.J.P. Taylor noted, Reith used the brute force of monopoly to stamp Christian morality on the British people. Because if you wanted to listen to any other radio, you couldn't until 1933, and then you'd have a very crackly Radio Luxembourg. There were no alternatives. In fact, in terms of radio, there were not going to be any other alternatives, in terms of legalised alternatives, until the 1970s. BBC had a monopoly for that time. Television, slightly differently. Commercial television came in to Britain in the 1950s, 1955, shortly after the BBC kind of effectively had its day of the coronation and so on. As I said, Reith's management style was seen as interventionist and centralising. If people are asking, why is the BBC so London-centric? Well, Reith was, even as a Scotsman, quite deliberate in wanting to base everything within London. Again, the sort of recent move to Salford, etc., a big change with respect to that. Certainly, from early on in his regime, he sought to move away from a BBC which was characterised by largely local coverage, which emanated from 19 main broadcasting stations, to one that was centred in London. And by 1930, local radio, in any shape or form, had effectively vanished. Reith replaced local radio with the national programme for London and the regional programme, which were produced from five centres in the regions, which served the Midlands, the North, the South, the West and Scotland. Northern Ireland and Wales were added later. Now, the national programme was in every sense the senior player, with the regions very much being seen as juniors. And throughout the 1930s, there are substantial frictions and tensions which actually existed between the centre, or London, and the regions. And Reith actually used those quite deliberately. He used a policy of divide and conquer, that if people are kind of fighting amongst themselves, they're not going to be fighting against him, so all's well with the world. Again, not necessarily the best playbook to adopt if you want to be remembered with any fondness, but at the same time, it's very effective. According to one former BBC employee called R.S. Lambert, who was editor of the BBC magazine The Listener, which ran until the start of this century, but basically Lambert edited it between 1929 and 1939, and his views were as follows. All personalities at the BBC were dwarfed by that of Reith, who tended to surround himself with yes-men on the control board, which consisted of the four or five appointees, and basically was the base bedrock on which the entire BBC was organised. So again, you have somebody who runs by fear, runs by a divide and rule policy, and so on and so forth. Again, is it any wonder that when he actually left to head off to British Airways that many people weren't necessarily sad to see him depart? Not least of which, of course, was this lady, Ellen Wilkinson, MP for Middlesbrough, and one of the major critics of the BBC in the 1930s, not on behalf necessarily of the newspapers, but specifically on behalf of the lack of coverage of the trades unions, the lack of coverage of the particular strikes that were taking place, and so on and so forth. She even basically sort of made a great show of sort of refusing to pay her licence fee as a result. So again, issues relating to that. Not surprisingly, the BBC was most proud of its national broadcasts. Its royal broadcasts, the biggest coup that the BBC had, was the Christmas message, the annual Christmas message, which became for such a long period of time, arguably still is in many cases, the kind of whole pinnacle of the Christmas season, the monarch addressing the nation. Again, not too dissimilar from the fireside chats that Roosevelt and the President of the United States would actually have in order to use the medium of radio, of broadcasting, to directly address the nation and the people. Certainly, from 1930 onwards, Reith would tend to pass off any interventions of the BBC as decisions that were not in the national interest. Strategically, he looked to go out of his way to avoid regulation, but again, that made the BBC susceptible to bullying, again, with respect to, obviously, the radio licence fee, etc. So you've got a mixture of problems with respect to things that occur there before, obviously, the Orwellian establishment there, and again very much part of the establishment, is seen and developed the building of Broadcasting House, you know, this kind of brutalist concrete architecture which effectively says the BBC are actually here to stay and will not be heading off in the near future. In 1935, again some 13 years after the British Broadcasting Company had been established, a BBC news department was formed. It was separate from the talks department, and it expanded steadily. By the end of 1938, not only had Reith actually departed, but the news department had actually grown to 31 staff, the majority of whom were recruited as experienced print journalists. So you're again gradually getting the sort of notion that suddenly journalism, broadcast journalism, can feed in to the national agenda from that point of view, the national broadcasting agenda. But interestingly enough, prior to that, during the late 1920s, the BBC News section had explicitly stated that it did not want anyone with ordinary popular journalistic expertise or experience. As the news section chief Geoffrey Strutt stated in 1927, "The whole aim and objective of the BBC News is to avoid the errors to which journalists are inevitably prey to fall, such as sensationalism, such as inaccuracy, impartiality and overstatement, or indeed partiality and overstatement." And so the argument was to develop this BBC News style of presenting news of all that is happening to the world and in the world in a clear, impartial and succinct language. Again, it's a kind of classic line where you check your sources before you go on air with them and so on. Now, as mentioned, by 1938, the content of the bulletins, which had by now established themselves, and they were raising up to 15 minutes per day of news, national and regional bulletins, etc., and they were comprised of a mixture of things that we'd recognise today. Four or five standard stories, weather news, sporting news, and so on. BBC journalists such as Kenneth Adam would cover a wide variety of events, ranging from the lying in state of George V, a speech by David Lloyd George, to the trades union movement, to a new play by George Bernard Shaw at the Malvern Festival. So again, that mixture of arts-based topics, of entertainment topics, of hard news topics, beginning to grow and develop. Richard Dimbleby, father of David Dimbleby and Jonathan Dimbleby, actually pioneered in Britain the art of the on-the-spot report, the use of recorded actuality sounds from the scene of the actual location itself. Again, his description of the burning down and the inflagration of the Crystal Palace was one of those examples that was developed within that. But still we see this development of a kind of Reithian culture which is there, which is seen as high and low culture, which again, arguably, it's not necessarily wrong to introduce people to things they might not necessarily have been interested in. It's very interesting that when war actually broke out in 1939, initially the BBC's response was to play nothing but somber classical music. And that was pretty much acknowledged that was the worst thing for the nation's morale. So you see, kind of around 1941-42, a big shift in terms of the growth of variety programmes. Tommy Hanley, It's That Man Again, Mrs. Mott, various other characters that effectively were developed primarily because they were poking fun at the establishment, were becoming much more popular and provided that balance in terms of what the BBC was being provided with, etc. Bandwagon being an early pre-World War II example of that whole range of things. So you're gradually seeing the BBC growing, finding its voice, developing its own position, and so on and so forth. So what about the national press? What about the way in which they were responding to them? And, OK, they'd acknowledged the BBC, they'd taken this on board as a radio service and so on, but then there's this other spectre at the feast that was around pre-war, suddenly is emerging now as being much more significant, the television receiver, the television set. Is it the death of radio? Is it the death of everything from that point of view? We've already seen in terms of radio, in that little snippet there, funny, I could have sworn that was a regional cough, the kind of flattening of what we call regionality and different systems and so on. Well, in terms of the growth of radio, that in itself was hugely overtaken by television, especially from the 1950s through to the 1960s and so on, where you see a number of key developments coming in place. First of all, as mentioned, you see the television programme replacing, in terms of its news aspects, the whole cinematic newsreel. In fact, the BBC newsreel service very much echoes the kind of television or the kind of filmic programmes that were actually there as well. You're seeing a development of news that sort of open up its whole system. I'll give you some numbers here. Television services started in Britain in 1936 with transmission area in and around the London area. After the Second World War, it sold faster than any other consumer item in history. I think the iPad, I think just about beat it. But prior to the iPad, nothing had actually sold faster in terms of consumer products than television at all. By 1954, half of the households in the United States of America actually had one television set, and a quarter of all households in Britain had at least one television set. Mostly these were owned by middle-class households. And the first mass event, the mass media event that certainly television hugely benefited from, was, as mentioned in 1953, the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, which we are still part of that second Elizabethan era. Over 20.5 million people, 56% of the adult population, watched the proceedings on television. Meanwhile, the Coronation Day edition of the Daily Mirror sold a record-breaking 7.1 million copies, more than any other British daily had actually sold either before or since. It sort of remains sort of bedrock of that. And as noted, until 1955, the BBC had the monopoly on television broadcasting in Britain, and its programme was geared up very much for a middle-of-the-road or a middle-class audience. Commercial television did not arrive until 1955. Commercial radio still hasn't taken part at all in this. Again, that's worth noting. But that whole arrival of commercial television, given the success of the American model, in which you can actually advertise your products on air, and the first ever commercial on British television was for toothpaste, Gibbs SR, is a whole new area, a whole new area to be developed. Whatever you feel about commercials, you can actually have those feeding into the programme as well. And you have that debate, of course, that, you know, you never watch the BBC, so therefore you shouldn't have to pay the licence fee because basically you pay for it through the free commercial television. Actually, that's not true because obviously the commercial budgets have to come from somewhere, and obviously the cost on various products for making the adverts and taking airtime in the first place comes out of that whole system. So it's a bit of an interesting quandary to actually work through, but we'll talk about that in seminars. So television is here, and it's here to stay. Certainly it is from the 1950s. More and more people are getting television sets, in addition to their radio sets, and so on. Multimedia areas are taking place. What about news? Well, news was problematic, surprise, surprise, during the 1950s, certainly on television. A daily news programme only began to appear from 1954 with BBC Television's News and Newsreel programme. And the BBC, which even in the 1950s, still the present day, you might say, was always fearful of being accused of political bias, sought to be as non-controversial as possible. Bit like the newsreel producers, if you remember. You know, newsreels wanted to produce things that effectively didn't upset people. So you're not going to go for hard-hitting news stories, etc. It also managed to follow this through by, between 1944 and 1957, implementing what became known as the 14-day rule. Now, I think this is worth considering just because if you think, what? Seriously? 14-day rule. The BBC agreed not to extend its coverage to issues relevant to either the House of Commons or the House of Lords for 14 days before they were being debated. So anything that was due to be debated in Parliament could not be spoken about on the BBC for at least 2 weeks beforehand. Those of you who are familiar with the rules of purdah will know that in terms of election coverage, you need to ensure that from the period that the election is declared, you give equal time to all parties. Fine. But this was something that went way beyond the election period. It wasn't basically imposed from above. It was self-imposed to effectively reduce the possibility of being accused of broadcasting any controversial political material. Interesting in terms of how could an investigative journalist develop a role there when you can't even talk about what's being discussed for at least a fortnight before it is being discussed. Now, this is great for newspapers, because newspapers don't have to actually go with that rule at all. And so, for that period, newspapers would produce an unrivalled political coverage. If they chose to do so, they would have no competition whatsoever from television news. In the mid-1950s, television critics accordingly voiced their disapproval of television news. And the Observer's television critic noted the following: "The sad fact has to be recorded that news on television does not exist. What has been produced nightly onto the television programmes is a little bulletin of news flashes composed of an announcer's voice, a caption, and an indifferent still photograph. This may pass as news, but it does not begin to pass as television." This was not something which hadn't happened before, because in the late 1920s, on Good Friday, because they didn't want to offend in any way, shape or form, the radio news bulletin of that evening effectively said that, "Good evening, there is no news today, good night." So again, work through that. By mid-1955, the BBC television news bulletin was composed of 10 minutes of news read by an off-screen male voice, accompanied by a series of still pictures. And it was only in the final days leading up to the launch of commercial television that things started to change. And in September 1955, the BBC introduced the faces of newsreaders to the camera, but didn't want to publicise their names. So you could see the newsreader talking to you, but no mention of who was reading the news. Now, you could argue, well, why can't we go back to those days? Why do we need to know that it's Rita Chakrabarty or George Alagaya or whomever reading the news? Why shouldn't they just be anonymous, etc.? Again, debate that we can work through. But it's interesting that it's the BBC responding, because they can see the way that the system is changing. That clearly we're looking at following a more Americanized view, in which news readers become almost celebrities in their own right for delivering the news and elements within there. That danger of personalizing the news as the voice of an individual, as opposed to what the BBC would consider to be a serious element that needed anonymity, was at the heart of that particular debate. And the emergence of the newsreader personality and a slightly less formal approach to broadcast news coverage resulted quite clearly from the arrival of independent television news, ITN, in September 1955. In contrast with the BBC's anonymous newsreaders, ITN's newscasters were given the freedom to rewrite the news to suit their own personal style, even to the extent of actually ending the news with a "and finally" item to raise a smile. Go back to newspapers. What impact did this emergence then in the mid to late 1950s and 1960s have upon newspapers? Well, once again, many in the newspaper industry were concerned, particularly as television news was emerging at a time when a number of national papers were being threatened with closure or actually closing. Indeed, such was the concern about the health of the newspaper industry that a Royal Commission was set up by Parliament in 1961 to look at the press. Some of the figures. Between 1949 and 1961, there were 17 daily and Sunday national newspapers that had ceased publication, and only 4 new titles had started. So 4 new titles, 17 closures. The newspapers which also seemed to be most badly affected by television news were what we would refer to as the mid-market newspapers. Newspapers like the Daily Herald, the News Chronicle, etc. There's the Daily Herald, very popular during the sort of the 40s, etc. But it couldn't sustain itself in an era where the public would be either going for more serious news, more refined news, or more populist news, etc. Commercial television, which also prompted quicker news coverage on the BBC, hit papers like the Daily Herald quite substantially. As I said, television news less of a worry for papers like The Times, The Daily Telegraph and The Guardian, because they produced much more detailed reporting than television could actually match. You've got lots of images going through on television over a 5 or 6 minute period. You can actually take time to actually read a 2, 3 or 4 thousand word article to reflect on what's being said, and so on and so forth. The equivalent of the red top tabloids, like the Daily Mirror, were also not particularly worried by television news, because they also foregrounded entertainment and human interest stories. You see a kind of symbiotic relationship in which you get the beginnings of what we now take for granted in terms of celebrities go across media. If they're popular on television, then maybe your newspaper will actually run stories about them, may use scandal stories about them, maybe all sorts of things that will work into place with that. Lord knows, we even have in this award season the National Television Awards and so on. So again, that all connects together. But if you're a broadsheet popular paper like the News Chronicle or the Daily Herald, and you're faced with television news which is reporting stories pretty much in the same way as you are, brightly and concisely, and with serious matters treated seriously, with the added additional attraction of moving pictures and stories actually going to screen within hours rather than still photographs the next day, then clearly you're going to have a problem. And once so dominant, as I say, mentioned now, I did a straw poll, anybody ever heard of the Daily Herald or the News Chronicle, etc., they effectively went the way of the dinosaur and no longer exist. However, the Daily Express and the Daily Mail do exist, although arguably they have been forced down market. They've had to actually become more populist in terms of their approach, etc., and certainly they shifted into tabloidisation. The advent of the Today newspaper in the 1980s, which was, again, a first foray that the daily newspapers made into colour printing, etc., proved to be, again, a fairly short-lived experiment. All newspaper incomes were also being affected by television, especially with the arrival of commercial television. Again, what are you going to invest your advertising budget in? You're going to go for the area that can deliver audiences to you. Hence that line, commercial broadcasting is in the business of delivering audiences to advertisers. The more, the bigger, the better in terms of how you're getting those messages across and so on. That competition for advertising had become much tougher as a result of ITV, which again, from the very beginning, took advertising revenue away from newspapers. We kind of see this now in terms of the demise of local newspapers and the fact that all the traditional ways in which local newspapers used to sustain themselves by having car sale adverts and property adverts and house adverts, etc., that's all gone online. And clearly, from that point of view, you're seeing a big knock-on effect in terms of where local broadcasting and local newspapers are based. In 1956, the press accounted for more than 90% of all money spent on news media advertising. 10 years later, by the mid-1960s, its share had declined to 65%. It's now down to around about 25-30%, if that. Substantial demises there in terms of what's available and what's being continued. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the coming of television had a negative impact upon newspapers, especially that mid-market sector. But there's also evidence to suggest that some sectors of the newspaper industry could use television as an advantage. Some, as I mentioned, were very quick to see the potential of television, and they actually bought substantial shareholdings in television companies, a bit like the newsreels. This, again, not an option of the BBC, because the BBC funded solely by the licence fee. So, again, separate from that point of view. The first major shift of television companies into other media, again, occurred in 1955 with that birth of independent television, ITV. And newspaper companies actually owned over 40% of shares in one of the major network companies, not too far away from here, in the Midlands, a company called Associated Television, or ATV. And that close relationship between the ownership of television and newspaper titles arguably still continues today, with the likes of Rupert Murdoch clearly owning News International, Fox TV, and so on and so forth. Again, a pattern of ownership in which you have a small number of individuals or companies owning a large group of papers and TV companies. And obviously Fox is also purchased by Disney, so again, all sorts of issues. Now, some of that sometimes causes concern. Why? Because if you are concentrating so much into so little in terms of ownership, do you actually allow for other voices who disagree with your particular viewpoint to be aired? Are we kind of almost going full circle to the days of Reith at the BBC, where if you don't agree, basically it's time to go for the highway, or you'd be exiled to the north, or some such thing? Now, leaving aside ownership, some newspaper companies and titles also saw the opportunity of television as really opening up a whole new subject area, The Sun being a particular example of this. The Sun was launched in 1964 and then relaunched as a tabloid by the aforementioned Rupert Murdoch in 1969. And what Murdoch did was to alter the approach of The Sun to news focusing much more on human interest stories. He also wanted lots of celebrity-led stories, which would be led by scandal and sexual innuendo, and it was a huge success. By 1975, The Sun was selling over 3.5 million copies a day. Fantastic. So, min-market dailies are losing sales because of ITV, The Sun gaining readers, probably for three reasons. One, many of the most popular stories of The Sun, and to a certain extent The Star, and possibly The Mail as well these days, would involve popular television personalities. Look at the BBC website, look at the headlines for all of the newspapers on a daily basis. See the kind of amount of stuff, in terms of content analysis, that's actually referring to populist showbiz stories, etc. Soap stars in particular need to be aware of this. The Royals, clearly another case in point. So in order to be aware of the significance of those TV stars, The Sun related to its readers watching television. It also is one of the pioneers of television advertising. Unlike many of its rivals, it was prepared to invest heavily in television advertising to attract additional readers and used ads using the slogan Super Soar Away Sun and lots of other issues. Bingo, of course, being another classic line in which things are coming through from that. Holidays for 99p or various other things. So those red top tabloids also rely on its readers in obtaining much of their information from television news. Because in most cases, television news does just give you the headlines. Unless you look at the documentary series and the accompanying sort of area, it doesn't go any further than that. And so actually you get the surface and nothing but the surface. You don't go into any further depth. And that enables the newspapers and themselves to take different, often mocking or comical approaches to stories, which it assumes its readers have already gained enough familiarity with. Whether you're addressing the European Union with Up Yours Delors, or indeed Charles bedded Camilla as Diana slept upstairs, or Di found knickers in Charles's pocket, etc., etc. Lots of sort of areas there that come into the play. So, to conclude, television doesn't have to be regarded as a threat to all types of newspapers. And radio at this stage, again, has also gone its own way and developed another level. And I haven't had a chance to actually speak about the growth of pirate radio in both the 60s and the 1980s and so on. But in terms of the agenda of the new newspapers, they don't compete directly with television news. So as a result, they're not really threatened by it. It's worth suggesting, again, as a concluding point, that with that investment the television companies make in terms of newspapers and vice versa, reaching its, some might say, peak, some might say nadir, in 1992, when Sky Sports decided to invest £300 million in the television rights to the then fledgling sort of footballing sport, the Premier League, etc. That's now in the billions. It's been a massive success. And again, let's talk about where does that go in terms of the future. Does it go online? Does that a case, you know, do you actually have Premflix in terms of the sort of Netflix equivalent for the Premier League, etc.? How are things being developed? We've already seen Amazon, other companies getting involved with respect to that. So it seems unlikely at the present day that that current rapidity of change in terms of television and broadcasting, certainly brought about by digitalisation, will necessarily bring about the death of the newspaper. But it may well, as has been the case over the last 100 or so years, bring about evolution in terms of the media. Thanks for listening. Make sure you've signed the register. And I look forward to seeing you again in the seminar.